Home prices fall again.
What's it mean for the housing market?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Adrienne Hill, in for Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Tuesday, December 27th.
Well, a bunch of Sears and Kmart stores will close. What's the problem there?
And a report on the growing wealth gap between U.S. lawmakers and the rest of us.
And airport security, Adrienne, in Las Vegas wasn't very sweet. We're going to tell you what they confiscated from one person later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We've got new housing numbers to report this morning. The S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index shows that home prices fell in most major cities in October. It's the second month of declines after a few months of slightly more positive news. For more, we've got Julie Neiman from Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. She joins us every Tuesday. Good morning, Julie.
Morning, Adrienne.
So what do you make of this drop in housing prices?
Well, there were very few bright spots. Areas within cities is what you saw, and then a few areas of the South and the Midwest. But again, it was very, very spotty. And the problem is October is the tail end of home buying season, so the coming month's news is not going to be cheery at all. No one moves in the winter unless you're forced to. Moreover, we currently have over about 3.3 million houses for sale. That's an eight-month inventory to work off of. 6 months supply on new homes. And the biggest reasons, you've got 20% down required now. You can do that only for the lower priced homes. Debt levels are still way too high for American consumers, and unemployment is still near 9%.
Now, you mentioned a few regional bright spots. Any other up good looking signs in the housing market right now?
Well, the one tick up happens to be in rentals, and rental rates are up very, very nicely. Speculators are buying and rehabbing smaller houses now and moving those into the rental markets, and there's good demand there. Multifamily units, apartments, good construction going on there. Permits are up about 37% over the last 11 months. This is really going to be our long-term trend now because incomes are not growing, consumer debt levels are still very high, and there's no turn in sight. But the good news is it's not getting perceptibly worse. But the American dream is not buying a house now, it's getting out of debt and getting out of mom and dad's basement.
Julie Neiman from Smith Moore & Company, thanks so much.
You bet.
Well, Julie, Adrienne, on this day after the day after Christmas, a good number of retailers are thanking Santa for what's turning out to be a pretty good sales year. But Sears and Kmart aren't feeling so much of the love. Sales at both chains have been down more than 5% in the last quarter. Paul Swinand watches the happenings at Sears for the consulting firm Morningstar. He's with us now from Chicago with the latest. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You got it. What's going on at Sears? What's wrong there?
Well, one thing that we've seen for the whole year is that appliance sales have been very weak. And Sears still has about 30% of the appliance market. So they're suffering from a cyclical decline in housing that just doesn't seem to end. At the same time, they've been underinvesting in stores, which tends to lose younger customers. So, you know, they're in a tough environment in retail. And then on top of that, their biggest category has an economic headwind.
So what does the company do to get back on track, do you think?
Well, that's the tough part because their competition, Target and Walmart and all your other retailers, especially Home Depot and Lowe's, is maybe not opening stores as quickly as they used to, but they are growing same-store sales, and they are probably attracting some of Sears' customers. I think they have to hope for just a cyclical turnaround in the appliance business. They have to spruce up the stores a little. And they've done a lot of work. For example, the Kardashian soft goods line, they are working to prove their soft goods business as well. So I think there is, you know, the possibility of seeing some light at the end of the tunnel. But they also have to hope that the economy cooperates in the next year or two.
Paul Swinand with Morningstar. Paul, thanks.
Thank you.
Despite the scroogey news from Sears and Kmart, there's a new number out today that's giving retail companies some cheer. That on Christmas Day, actually on the 25th, people were buying stuff, using gift cards and taking advantage of big sales. online shopping that day was up more than 16%.
Which, of course, has us thinking, Adrian, about how that stuff will get to all those houses, right, by shipping companies such as FedEx, which is, by the way, planning to increase rates for ground and home delivery about 5% starting in January. But will that bust some of the online retail boom? From Nashville Public Radio, Blake Farmer reports.
You can't blame gas prices. Memphis-based FedEx is reducing a fuel surcharge, which will offset some of the rate hike. The truth is, FedEx is busy, says analyst Art Hatfield with Morgan Keegan.
Quite frankly, right now, transportation markets are fairly tight.
Hatfield says FedEx has to charge higher rates so it can afford to hold on to good employees. Online retailers will be some of the ones absorbing the cost. Consumers have become conditioned to expect free shipping, which isn't free at all to online retailers. Shipping costs ate up 18% of their revenues this year, according to market research firm Ibis World. And free shipping isn't going away.
It's definitely a bigger deal this year.
Rob Kuhn is Senior Vice President of DidaComp, which helps small businesses run their e-commerce operations.
Still seems like something that they'll need, especially with the threat of 2012 internet sales tax rules changing.
Online retailers could be forced to collect state sales taxes in the next few years. Kuhn says they can't afford to drop free shipping and still compete with brick-and-mortar stores. I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
It's been a sharply partisan year for Congress. The payroll tax cut extension was just one of those fights. And Congress did work out a two-month deal that extends the payroll tax cut and the unemployment benefits, too. But that deal only lasts through the end of February. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genter now reports we can look forward to even more partisan sniping in 2012.
The fighting will only get worse next year because it's an election year. A conference committee of House and Senate members will try to hammer out a compromise on whether to keep the payroll tax deal through the end of 2012. In the middle of last week's partisanship, President Obama wondered why Congress couldn't compromise when the majority wanted to continue the payroll tax break.
I mean, has this place become so dysfunctional that even when people agree to things, we can't do it?
The immediate debate is how to pay for a year-long payroll tax cut. Oh, and once Congress resolves that, it has to decide whether to make the Bush tax cuts permanent. They expire at the end of next year. And don't forget the looming battle over automatic budget cuts scheduled for 2013. Some members of Congress want to spare the Pentagon and other domestic programs from the axe. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a widening wealth gap between those in Congress and the people they represent. That's the takeaway from a new Washington Post report. Peter Woreski wrote the article and joins us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
So what did you find?
We found that the net worth of a member of Congress has gone up 2.5 times over the last 25 years, whereas the average American net worth has remained stagnant. These are figures that don't include home equity, but the average American's net worth is about $20,000, whereas the average member of Congress net worth was in about $280,000 back in 1984 and is about $725,000 today, and those are in 2009 dollars.
And why is it happening?
Well, that's the big question. I think that the income inequality and wealth inequality in the United States in general probably has something to do with that. The second piece of that is specific to Congress, though, and the amount of money that it now takes to run a winning campaign, that's gone up several times. So if you have some money, extra money lying around and you can afford to spend it on a campaign, you're more likely to win.
Why does this growing wealth gap between lawmakers and their constituents matter?
It matters in that there's not a lot of research on this, but there was some pretty good research by a Duke University professor recently that showed that people of different occupations vote differently. You can also see it in polls about how people feel about, say, taxes on the rich. If you're not among them, you're more likely to obviously think that they ought to be taxed a little higher.
Peter Woreski is a staff writer with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now to the marketplace global perspective. Today there is a deal that's going to allow Japan and India to swap their currencies for U.S. dollars. Now that's going to make it easier for those countries to do business with one another, and also a way for Japan to settle the yen's increased volatility. Jake Schlesinger is the Wall Street Journal's Tokyo Bureau Chief. He's with us now. Hey, Jake.
Hey.
So tell us a little bit about this currency deal between India and Japan.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is the second, or actually third, big currency deal that Japan is signing with another Asian country in the last couple of months. They signed one with Korea in October. They did one with China just over the weekend, and now this week Prime Minister Noda will do the same with India. But they're actually kind of different. The ones with India and South Korea are really emergency backup swap lines that are designed to create a sense of stability and a feeling of backup to markets worried about volatility. The ones with China is actually about trying to deepen the market for Chinese currencies.
All right, so stability, but I mean, is there something bigger going on here in Japan?
You know, I think it has more to do with the fact that, in an odd way, Japan is back, meaning Japan was written off as largely irrelevant, increasingly irrelevant to the global and the Asian economies, overshadowed by faster-growing countries from China, India, like China, India, and Korea. I think what people have come to realize is Japan actually still does have a very important role to play. Even though it's been eclipsed by China, it still has the largest, deepest, most mature financial markets, and that it plays a very important role in trying to make sure that there's stability amid a lot of craziness in financial markets.
Jake Schlesinger with the Wall Street Journal. Jake, thanks.
Sure.
Some folks just weren't satisfied with their snow-free Christmas this year, Steve.
Most of the country didn't have snow, Adrian.
Well,
I know.
And so some people took matters into their own hands. According to ABC News, the fake snow business is booming in places.
I went to one of these shopping malls here in L.A., the Grove over there.
And they had fake snow?
They had fake snow, and it was soap suds.
Well, what we're talking about here is actually the icy stuff. They take ice, they melt it, they make flakes. So real snow
okay,
here.
Okay, all right.
So think 70-foot snow slides, snow for snowmen, snow for snowball fights.
Yeah.
The cost of your private winter wonderland?
How much?
$20,000.
Oh!
Depending on how many snowballs you actually want to make.
Wow.
You can do it for cheaper.
Next time you crack open a Budweiser beer, consider this. The family that brought you that kind of beer has been out of the brewing business now for the past 3 years. But one member of the Busch family isn't about to tap out the keg. From St. Louis, reporter David Weinberg explains.
In 2008, Belgian beverage giant InBev purchased Anheuser-Busch for $52 billion, and it ended the nearly 150-year reign of the Busch family in the beer business. Sort of. Billy Busch, the great-grandson of founder Adolphus Busch, was not among the family members forced to sign a non-compete agreement. He assembled a seasoned management team that includes former Anheuser-Busch executives, and this fall, he founded the William K. Busch Brewing Company.
There hasn't been a new beer in the premium lager category for years. So we decided to go big.
Busch unveiled two beers, Kräftig and Kräftig Light, based on German recipes. He's already brewed more than 7,000 barrels.
Well, I've been here 31 years. I don't remember anything like this.
Ben Steinman is the editor of Beer Marketers Insight.
It is a very ambitious, well-capitalized. They're aiming right at the heart of the marketplace.
The William K. Busch Brewing Company has made it very clear that they are not a microbrewery. They intend to compete directly with Budweiser and Coors. Kräftig brewmaster Mark Gottfried is what you might call a beer brewing prodigy. He started making beer in his room at the age of 14. By 21, he was a full-fledged brewmaster. Then one day, out of the blue, he got a phone call from Billy Busch.
I often tell the story that I thought it was a prank call, and this phone rings, and I was like, Mark, this is Billy Busch. And of course, I think I pulled the phone away from my ear. I'm staring at it. Is this for real?
Kräftig is currently brewed under contract in La Crosse, Wisconsin, but Busch and Gottfried plan on breaking ground on a new brewing facility in St. Louis in the next year or two.
The heritage that's in this town is what sparked me to become a brewer. And for us to bring that back, or even just to take a shot at bringing it back, it's a chance at writing brewing history.
For now, Kräftig is only available in St. Louis, but the company hopes to build a nationwide distribution network in the coming year. In St. Louis, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
It was a big weekend for sports. Notably, the NBA started its much-delayed season, and the Clippers are actually a pretty good-looking team.
Oh, the Clippers here in L.A., the often maligned L.A. Clippers. Of course, the shadow of the big brother L.A. Lakers,
yes,
who
but
didn't have quite the success that they were hoping.
But there is bigger news.
Yeah, football. A big record was broken with a pigskin. Quarterback Drew Brees of the New Orleans Saints is now the NFL's record holder for the most yards passing in a single season. Last night, he won that title in the Saints' win against the Atlanta Falcons. He beat Dan Marino's old record from the 1980s.
So in today's Midday Extra, we want to talk about broken sports records, new records, and what they mean for sports and the athletes who break them.
And Jeff Duncan is a columnist from the New Orleans Times Picayune. He's with us from the Big Easy right now. Hey, Jeff.
How's it going? Good morning.
Doing well. I'm sure you had a late night last night, didn't you?
Yes, it went late. Of course, they had to wait till the very last pass to break this record, which is always great for us newspaper deadline.
Why is breaking this record such a big deal?
Well, I think more than anything, to Drew Brees and Sean Payton and even the city of New Orleans, it was a validation. You know, this is a small market here. It's for a long time, the franchise was one of the worst in the NFL.
Yeah.
And Drew Brees keeps coming in second in the MVP race. He's going to come in second again this year. And to me, it seemed almost like Peyton and the fans wanted to celebrate and coronate their hero on a national stage and say, hey, he may not win an MVP, but this is his moment, and let his greatness be exposed to a global or a national audience.
And so what's a record like this mean today compared to what it meant back in 1984 when Dan Marino set it?
Oh, it's so much greater. The NFL is such a Goliath now compared to when Marino broke it. It's by far the biggest pro sports industry in the world. Now it vaults Drew Brees into another stratosphere as far as an endorsement and sponsorship, athlete. He, I think, now has a chance to get up there with a guy like Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, who really are the pinnacles, I think, as far as marketing in the NFL. And for Brees to do it in a small market like New Orleans, he's already kind of gotten there with that Super Bowl MVP. I think this just takes him to another level because it happened on Monday Night Football, the game's preeminent event. The Saints, for four decades, were largely the doormat of the league.
Yeah.
And Brees single-handedly has brought this franchise to a different level, to becoming an everyday winner. And I think the Katrina narrative played a part in this, where the Saints now are one of the big draws in the NFL, and I think part of that had to do with what happened here after Hurricane Katrina, and Brees was seen as the torchbearer for that.
And what does a success like this mean to the team, but also to New Orleans?
Well, it's huge for the city right now. I mean, this is a something of a boom town right now. Post-Katrina New Orleans, the recovery has, we've finally kind of gotten over the hump here, and there's a lot of young people moving to this city right now, a lot of tech startup companies moving here. The post-Katrina education movement, basically the changeover in the school system here has been celebrated in the education field. We've got, sports-wise, we've got BCS National Championship game coming up here in 2 weeks.
That's right.
And the men's Final Four here is later this spring, and then next year the Super Bowl is here. So there's all kinds of businesses in terms of tourism, hotel industry is booming. It's really a cathartic time in the city right now. It has very much a feel of pre-Katrina New Orleans when it was a global destination city.
Sounds like there's going to be a lot for you to write about, too.
Yeah,
it's a good time to be a sports writer in this town, that's for sure.
Jeff Duncan, reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff.
My pleasure. Y'all take care.
Well, December is a big month for charitable giving. About half of all private donations are made this month, many in this last week of the year. Reporter Andrea Gardner tells us where we're directing our giving these days.
As the economy wobbles along, Americans want their dollars to stretch even further, not just when they buy, but also when they donate. Ken Berger runs CharityNavigator.org, a site that rates charities based on performance.
There's a sense that every dollar is more precious than ever, and that it's essential that it get to the high-performing nonprofits.
Berger says this year, more donors also favor charities that help the most needy people. Many are choosing health and human service charities like homeless shelters and food pantries. Marvin Gross is CEO of Union Station Homeless Services in Southern California. He says new donors often reference the economy and high unemployment rates as their reason for giving.
People will come to us. They say, we know it's a tough time. We know a lot of people are suffering. We know you help those who are in need.
In a recent survey, half of all health and human service charities said donations were up in 2011. Other types of nonprofits, like education and arts charities, reported lower rates of growth. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Looking for a place to open your business? Well, in Phoenix, entrepreneurs have been shunning traditional retail storefronts in favor of industrial space. But it turns out city planners and even some landlords aren't nearly as enthusiastic. Peter O'Dowd has the story.
Exhale. Good. Inhale.
The folks at Hegel Yoga wanted something big.
So you can let go and breathe and not feel claustrophobic.
And Tish Hegel found it here in this warehouse in Tempe, just east of Phoenix.
When I moved over here, I doubled my square footage and my rent went down by a third.
Hegel is like a lot of other non-industrial business owners in the Phoenix area getting a deal on empty warehouses. After the financial meltdown, all sorts of industrial buildings emptied out and rents are now more than 20% cheaper. Hegel had no trouble renting the space, but not every business owner is so lucky. Rob Martinson is a broker with the real estate firm Colliers International. His cautionary tale took me to a 30,000-square-foot warehouse near a suburban airport. The building went up at the height of the real estate boom.
So it's been vacant for quite a while.
Was there ever a tenant in it?
Nope.
There was plenty of interest, mostly from non-traditional tenants like a skateboard park and a military museum. But these users needed expensive zoning adjustments and permits. In this case, the landlord didn't want to bother.
You could spend a lot of money to improve the building, and then if that tenant goes broke, you end up losing even more money. A lot of times, it's just not worth the risk.
Eventually, the warehouse went into foreclosure. Sometimes, it's cities themselves that keep non-traditional tenants out of industrial buildings. Churches have moved into many warehouses, but not in the suburb of Glendale.
That can be a challenge.
John Froke is the planning director. Zoning laws forbid churches in Glendale industrial parks.
If I'm an industrial user and I've spent $1 million on building up my business, I don't really want to be impacted if somebody next door is going to complain about noise, dust, heavy trucks.
But the city doesn't want to turn away potential tenants. Froke has helped churches looking for warehouses find space more compatible with their use. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
Finally today, here's something to remember, Adrian, as you're taking to the skies this busy holiday week. So many people are going to the airports, right, traveling around the country. Some food items just are not sacred to the Transportation Security Administration. You've been through those lines, right?
I have.
Pat-downs, and you got to go through, you know, this and
that. I've actually had them take food away from me.
Oh, really?
Like a Nutella kind of product.
I want to talk about this in just a second. Yeah, well, a woman going through security at the Las Vegas airport was stopped by the TSA. Her carry-on bag and other personal items got the okay, the green light from the screeners. But one item did not get through. It wasn't Nutella.
What was it?
It was her cupcake.
Oh, no.
She had a cupcake that she was taking on board the plane with her. And the TSA says that they have rules. It says cakes and pies are okay to carry on a plane. But that one agent was suspicious of the cupcake's frosting.
Suspicious or hungry?
Yeah, maybe hungry. You never know. He said it violated the agency's liquids and gels rule, which I guess would lend itself to your Nutella story, right?
Yes.
I mean, maybe that could be damaging. Who knows? Maybe someone could be nefarious with their Nutella.
Or their cupcake. You know, if that was my cupcake, Steve, I would have just eaten it right in front of the agent.
Right there.
Yeah.
I mean, I've done that all the time with the bottled water. If I have like a half full bottle, I just chug it right there.
Smash it right into my face.
And then I throw the, you know, hopefully there's a recycling bin, you know. Anyway, she didn't, I don't know if she ate the cupcake or not, but I know that it did not get through TSA security. So in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Adrian Hill. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.